Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
This is Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Here are your hosts, Paul Breitbart and Kay Royal.
Last March, researchers at Maastricht University published the first ever complete corporate social responsibility framework for data protection, aimed at improving privacy and security for a sustainable digital future. The framework translates theoretical ethical principles into tangible and practical guidelines for companies and organizations that process personal data. Spearheading the process is Paolo Balboni, who is attached to Maastricht University's European Center on Privacy and Cybersecurity as Professor of Privacy, Cybersecurity, and IT Contract Law. Next to his university role, Professor Balboni is also one of the founders of ICT Legal Consulting, an Italo-Dutch law firm with offices around the world, and he has many other roles in privacy as well, including as the chairman of the Data Protection Board of the European Patent Office. And we are very happy to welcome him as a guest. My name is Paul Breitbart.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. So I am absolutely thrilled to have Paolo here today. Trust me, Paul's going to have probably a lot more questions for him than I will, but I'll do my best to keep up. But with that, Paolo, welcome. And are you ready for the unexpected question?
Well, absolutely. I'll try my best. And first and foremost, thank you very much for inviting me to have this opportunity to discuss with you. Thank you.
We're excited to have you. And also maybe as a disclaimer, Paolo and I work together quite a lot, both at the university and at the patent office. So there is some overlap between our CVs right now.
That's correct. Absolutely.
Okay, so.
So, Kay, the unexpected question.
It's an easy one. What was the last fruit you ate?
I ate a banana.
I love bananas.
I don't. For me, it was an apple.
Paolo, I think we're going to have to kick him off the podcast.
Okay.
Okay, have a good night. Bye.
Mine was a banana as well.
I have to say I'm consuming quite a lot of them because I recently plan once again to run a marathon. So I'm now restart my training. So, and it's fun enough because last time that I ran a marathon, which was in Amsterdam last year, I swear God not to do it anymore. And now I'm back, you know, on the same, making the same mistake, but keeps me motivated in my private and professional life as well.
You know, I like that.
So I guess it's true what they say that running a marathon is.
Yeah, kind of, absolutely, yeah.
Very good.
And bananas are good for athletes.
Yeah, they're supposed to be good, right?
Not my excuse.
Not mine either. Okay, Paolo. I told already at the introduction, you are doing quite a lot in privacy and data protection. But why did you end up in privacy as a young lawyer? How did you end up in this particular field of law?
Well, Paul, absolutely by chance. It was, I think, exactly 10 years ago when I was a exchange student at Tilburg University. I had the fortune to attend a lecture of Paul de Aert. Paul de Aert is a very well-known professor now, but back in time, he was a PhD student. And at the end of his lecture, which was very interesting about privacy, he mentioned that the topic of the lecture was very suitable to do a PhD. So after the lecture, I approached him and I asked him, what is a PhD exactly? And he explained me what was a PhD, so like doing research, writing a book, and I said, oh, wow, this is quite challenging, actually. But then he told me, well, if you do a PhD at Tilburg University, you know, we're going to provide you with an accommodation and a salary. And I was like, what? really? And then I said, well, let me think about that. And, you know, before we all knew, a few months later, I ended up doing a PhD at Tilburg University and, you know, getting acquainted with my first steps into the privacy and data protection domain. So that was a story.
Wow. And how does Tilburg compare to, I think you studied in Bologna, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, I graduated in Bologna, yeah, and I come from Bologna. I'm 100% Bolognese, we could say.
But how does Tilburg compare?
Well, I think they have two completely different approaches, and I think you can also see that probably Italian universities are more traditional than Dutch universities. There are pros and cons. I think Dutch university have the pros of better preparing students for a quick jump into a working environment. Whereas Italian universities, I think they have the pro of stimulating more in-depth analysis of things. And so I would say that I was lucky enough to have a sort of combination of the two, and I benefit a lot from, you know, combining this method.
And then in 10 years from considering to start a PhD to being a full professor at Maastricht University, that's very quick.
Well, actually, I need to rectify because it was actually 20 years ago.
Ah, that makes more sense.
Sorry, but I mean, sometimes it's very difficult. Sometimes it's very difficult to go back 20 years and accept that when you say it, basically. Because it was 2002 and now we are 2022. So it was actually 20 years ago. Sorry. Yeah.
But still, even 20 years between starting your PhD and becoming a professor is fairly quick.
Yeah, I don't know. Quick or not, but I think things came one after the other. And I think at the end of the day, I consider myself extremely lucky. And of course, you need to, you know, help your luck by, you know, substantial work ethics. But I think I found myself multiple times as the right person in the right place, I guess. And I hope it's going to be the same also for the next 20 years or more.
Yeah, that sounds really good.
Well, I'll admit I'm jealous of being the professor because I started my PhD 11 years before I actually finished it. So it took me that long to finish my PhD because they wouldn't let me do it on privacy. But my dream job is to be a full-time professor.
I think it's interesting to have that position in the academia, but like, for me, I think it works because I'm combining it with practice, in the sense that I think it's very personal. It depends what somebody wants to do, but I find very, very interesting to try to combine both the academic dimension and the practice dimension. And I think, you know, in our journey together, in our adventure together, Paul, as, you know, part of the data protection board of the European Patent Office, that is adding an additional dimension that you probably already experienced that to some extent, Paul, when you were working at the Dutch Data Protection Authority. But I haven't experienced before. And I think it's also very interesting to see things from that perspective. So, once again, I think I'm lucky enough to have a little bit of variety, and variety makes things, I think, richer and more interesting and more stimulating.
Yeah, no, I fully agree there, and that's also my experience, that the combination of the different roles, both in terms of the business work that I'm doing right now and the academic work that I can do at the university, and some of the supervision work that we do at the patent office, and it all combines and it all reinforces each other as well when you look at certain issues, how you approach them.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. Yeah.
So when you held your inaugural lecture at Maastricht University, you already painted a vision of the research that you wanted to do, looking into ethics, looking into corporate social responsibility, all in relation to data protection. And apparently it was something that you had been considering for a while already before you gave your inaugural lecture. Why? How did you come up with this topic?
Well, actually, this time I would correctly say 10 years ago when I had the opportunity to start following quite closely the privacy reform around Directive 9546, you know, being then replaced by the General Data Protection Regulation, I started to understand many things that I didn't know before. For example, that when you go through a legislative process, it's not always the aim to have the best law possible. I think I was naive enough to think about that. But it's a compromise, especially of political and economic aspects. That was one big lesson that I've learned. The second one is that typically, if you want to create a new regulation or a new directive respecting the European lawmaking process, this is going to take probably not less than 4 years, which is something probably completely inadequate to regulate digital activities, I think. And that was another big lesson that I've learned. And the last lesson is that regardless of how good may be a law or how specific you are in the lawmaking process, you will never be able to achieve really the goals if you don't have a common understanding of the stakeholders to try to do good. And I think and that was the third lesson that I've learned in that journey. And if you put everything together, I think it ended up in my mind realizing that the law will never be enough, will never be perfect, and will never be timely enough to regulate the digital domain. So I started to, probably at the beginning more unconsciously, and then towards 2015-16 more consciously, think about how could we address this gap, which is a fundamental gap in the digital society and digital economy. And then I started to, you know, look at soft regulation, core regulation. I started to expand my research into ethics, into the social domain, the philosophical domain at the same time. And then I managed to, I think, combine them, or I found beneficial to try to combine them around the concept of social responsibility. And I still remember that towards the end of GDPR journey, I had a conversation with Jan Albrecht, that was the rapporteur, right, for the GDPR, that actually I met last week again after a few years at the CPDP in Brussels. And I shared with him this vision, and I said, look, I appreciate very much all the work that you have put in order to, you know, bring all the parties together and realize the GDPR at the end of the day. But I think we shouldn't stop here. We should, you know, try to progress and develop our thoughts into a different dimension, that was data protection as a corporate social responsibility. And then we lost a little bit contact. So I'm very happy that I met him again after the project has been realized, and hopefully we can maybe work in the future again on this topic.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And you said the project is finished. You released a very lengthy paper, some 90 pages or so, outlining the ideas, 5 principles, 25 rules in total. Can you tell me a bit more what the concept entails that you developed?
Yeah, I think first I would like to say that this is just a portion of the research. So I'm now working together with Kate Francis, who is the PhD student that is working with me and providing substantial support in this research. We are working together to complete our book on data protection as a corporate social responsibility. And there we'll find place the full version of our research. So what you see available now online is sort of a substantial preview of the whole research. Anyway, when we look at the framework, as you correctly mentioned before, we have five main principles, and the principles are, let's say, around the concept of, first one, data protection, data security, and fairness by design, the first pillar. The second pillar is about transparency, so how to effectively provide transparency to data subject. The third one is about balancing profit for organizations and benefit for citizens. And the fourth pillar is about sharing information, sharing relevant findings created by the processing of personal data. And there we discuss about business-to-consumer data sharing, business-to-business, business-to-government, business-to-research, and business-to-humanitarian action organization data sharing. And the last pillar is about devolving a portion of the revenues to awareness campaign in order to improve the understanding, especially of new and digital generations. So without having now the presumption to go in depth into the, you know, five controls per each principle, I think we design a framework whereby on the one side, the fairness and security are central together with transparency, and then the part on data sharing and awareness are very, very fundamental. And I think, if I may, I would also add one interesting control that we have under the principle, which is about balancing profit with the benefit for citizens. Now we all talk about, climate change and the possibility that the social responsibility of trying to do something. And there, I think we have tried to capture in Rule 4 of Principle 3 this commitment of try to have an impact also with respect to the environment through minimizing data processing activity. I think this is an interesting angle, because now with a very cheap computational capacity and sometimes poor data governance processes and procedure within corporation, you have a lot of redundant databases. So you have a lot of unmaintained data sets, lost applications with the personal data inside. And all of this is also creating, more CO2, more consumption of energy, and so on and so forth. So we also want to take into consideration that specific domain, thinking about how to, enforce the principle of finality, data minimization, data retention, proportionality, and work with digital waste, digital data waste.
I like that principle. It's been a sore point of mine for a long time that there are these black holes of data that are just sitting out there unmaintained, unmanaged, completely forgotten, yet they're just sitting there waiting to harm someone.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is actually happening in real life. We saw it here in the Netherlands a few years ago when one of the airlines had a massive data breach, which especially involved data that was many, many years old. Some data up to 12 or 14 years old, and they were actually heavily fined for that breach by the Dutch Data Protection Authority. So such a black hole of data is not just also something that you pay storage for and that you pay an environmental price for, but it's also just an organizational and a reputational risk of non-compliance.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, Paul. And I think, for example, in our framework, that control will connect also with the control on data security by design. And of course, as you mentioned before, leading a managed data set, sometimes even exposed to the internet, it gives, a possible threat for an organization and a possible vector of attacks by, malevolent third parties. So I think another important point of the framework, this was just an example of connection, is that we have tried to create a set of controls that are somehow all very much connected. And I think this concept of connection is also another concept that I thought a lot when I devised this framework. You could see data protection as a corporate social responsibility as a sort of connecting tissue between legal compliance, between ethics, between, you know, the social and human rights domain mm-hmm. of privacy and data protection. So my hope is that through this concept and through this articulated framework, we start to build connecting tissues where there are gaps. And then, you know, slowly but steadily start filling those gaps so that at the end of the day, there is going to be effective protection of individuals on the one side. And on the other side, also the possibility for organization to truly circulate and even monetize personal data, because that would be the combination of, you know, important items that I think we have on the table right now. And the European Union is typically acting in the legislative mode, you know, with all the new proposals in the pipeline to regulate data, artificial intelligence, and so on and so forth. And I hope this will be a sort of connecting tissue also among all this kind of new legal framework with the intention of, you know, doing good with data.
So could you say that the report that you and Kate have drafted also forms a bit of the bridge between the Data Protection Office and the ESG councils, Environment, Social and Governance councils?
Yeah, I think it should be interpreted like this, and it should be operationalized like this. We also have created a specific function within our framework, which is called the coordinator of the DPCSR. So the DPCSR coordinator. And if you wish, that figure would be a sort of intermediary between different functions and forces within an organization. So definitely with the functions responsible for ESG, but also with the functions responsible for privacy compliance, but also with the business and even like the board of directors. So a sort of playmaker within this organization that will be able to take into consideration, you know, different objectives and try to reconcile them with what we always, you know, teach also at Maastricht University, this Janusian thinking approach. So try to look at things from different perspective and try to reconcile the opposite. So the presumption here and the hope is that this DPCSR coordinator will be good enough to try to reconcile, you know, the corporation need to do business and to monetize personal data with, you know, more compliance functions and privacy function with ethical functions or more generally the ESG compliance domain. All at the end, putting at the center the data subject, so making sure that this is done for an effective protection of data subject, which on the other side will also pay back the return of investment, because we have studied that especially youngsters are more and more sensitive about sustainable business. So they're really looking for products and services that are more sustainable, that are more socially mm-hmm. responsible. And on the other side, you also see investment funds that are now extremely focused on investing money in sustainable business. So we have a sort of, from the financial world and from the consumer world, a lot of attention for sustainability. And I think, you know, this framework, data protection as a corporate social responsibility framework, could serve, you know, both sides, both, you know, consumers, data subjects, and shareholders, investors, so that business is made in a responsible.
Paolo, this framework was developed on the basis of the GDPR, I think. How do you see it being useful also in other jurisdictions around the world?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. Actually, I got a similar question also last week at the CPDP conference in Brussels. And I think the ambition here is that we actually take legal compliance with the applicable privacy legislation for granted. Let me explain a little bit better. We are not naive to say all companies already comply with GDPR or other applicable privacy legislation. Absolutely not. But we don't, this framework is not supporting legal compliance. It's not aimed at legal compliance. But we work on the basis of a compliance framework that is already existent. So everything that you will find in our DPCSR framework is on top of mandatory legal compliance. And I think in that respect, changing the attention of the framework from pure fulfillment of applicable duties and obligation and moving towards doing good with data on these five different dimensions will also serve giving the possibility of, you know, doing business with organizations adhering to this framework when there is no, for example, data protection legislations in place or bridging connections between legislation that are not consistent one with the other. Because if there is the common intention and the final good of putting the individual at the center and try to do business with data or to process personal data in a way that will not harm the individual and try to give back to society in terms of knowledge, in terms of awareness, and so on and so forth. I think it will create a sort of, you know, common language around doing good with data that will transcend a specific legal obligation and will go basically on top of that, or it will actually try to compensate when there is no applicable data protection legislation in a specific country, for example.
Okay, how do you look at all of this? Because you've been writing about ESG in relation to privacy before. You are operationalizing a data protection compliance program right now. Any use in this for you?
So, yes, absolutely. I mean, I absolutely resonate with the premise that privacy is corporate social responsibility. It should be measured along with the other ESG principles, but also the fact that I love how, Paolo, you take the position that companies can monetize data as long as they prioritize the individual safety and fundamental rights. And I've long believed in that. I've been a privacy person for many, many years that, one, early on, I believed in cloud services, and two, I believe in the innovative value of data to a company. I absolutely believe that you can use data creatively. Thank you. Why is my brain not working either? I absolutely believe that companies can creatively use data to innovate. And so I love your framework. I think it absolutely goes the right direction. I was wondering what feedback you've gotten from any corporations on it, if at all.
Yeah, there is a lot of interest, and there has been a lot of interest since the beginning. I think it is also important to take the chance to confirm that we specifically decided at the very beginning to work on this framework with European data protection and business stakeholders, and European only. In that respect, I want to explain a bit this idea, because whoever knows me knows that I'm not somebody that is only looking at privacy data protection from the European perspective, or that I think that in Europe, you know, our framework is better than other framework. I always look with a lot of interest to other frameworks, and I also had the chance in the past to draft a framework of a country, the country of Suriname.
Interesting.
And I had the opportunity to look into, you know, different examples and different frameworks. But we are all aware of big criticism around corporate social responsibility, around ethics, you know, ethic whitewashing, and so on and so forth. So we want to specifically address this in our paper. So in our paper, you will find specifically address, you know, the issue of ethic whitewashing and similar issues and how we went about it to try to differentiate ourselves. The second one, we wanted to create a, a sort of common understanding in Europe first on this new concept, and then try to open up to bridge connection with other data protection stakeholders outside the European Union. Like, for example, the Brazilian authority, who has been very, very collaborative, very interested, very supportive in our framework. And in the future...
Not surprising.
With more, and in the future also more authorities. So long story short, I think, had the opportunity to work with a number of very supporting and participating stakeholders. Now we have the framework, and now we are ready to open up to potentially and also to big corporation. And of course, we have been contacted by quite a significant number of corporations that would like to better understand which are the next steps, in the sense that now the framework is there.
Right.
The full research will be published within this year, with also a toolkit for implementation. And of course, big corporation wants to know, okay, how can we adhere? Will you create a seal?
Right.
How do you evaluate the submission?
Right.
Will it be a self-assessment, a third-party mm-hmm. assessment? Who is going to carry out the assessment? And so on and so forth. So now we are having a lot of conversation with different big organizations in order to share with them such information. Some are already available, some other are not, because also Maastricht University is now, you know, trying to figure out how to manage all this, because we came out with this idea and it's not something that resonates always within a university organization. So they are trying to understand how we go about it. And hopefully soon we're going to have, the blessing of the legal service of the university and create a public registry that we will maintain, where all the companies or organizations will be listed, you know, adhering to this framework. Then we have thought about two mechanisms of adherence. One is a self-attestation, and the other one is a third-party attestation. The first one will be an organization declaring that they adhere to the framework. Of course, they need to have the data protection as a corporate social responsibility coordinator trained by us, by the center, and, you know, also being able to show in terms of accountability how they truly comply with this framework. And the other part...
Yeah, enforcement on the self-regulation part would be very difficult. We have found that with other regimes, that if you don't have some sort of outside entity that is enforcing adherence to it, and I'm assuming Maastricht University would not want to be the entity enforcing against companies. I mean, they have no authority to do so. So
absolutely.
How would you manage that part? Or do you think the self-attestation and the self-regulation would be stringent enough to have a validity to outside parties?
Well, I think one thing that is going to make the difference, I think, is how much attention we generate around this framework. Because if I'm a corporation and I appoint the DPCSR coordinator and I go out with a public statement on a public registry saying I comply, right? Mm-hmm. And then after that, there is going to be an audit, let's say, carried out by accredited auditors saying, okay, we truly want to understand how you comply with this framework. And at the end, they found that there are some gaps. Then ideally, the auditors will report the gaps to us, so to Maastricht University, that manage the public registry. And then we can notify the organization, for example, to cure those gaps within a certain amount of time. We can also take, ideally, more stringent actions, like, for example, suspending the listing. Let's say companies under investigation, something
right.
like that. And then even going further and revoking the listing and the certificate, let's say the seal. So at the end of the day, the university will never be able to enforce anything, but we don't want to enforce. We just want to expose best practice to the market and to the whole world. And then if there is something wrong about that, we also want to, in a very transparent way, say, look, that organization does not fulfill the requirements anymore. And then this is going to be clearly stated. So that is a bit of an idea.
Good. Does Europe have an unfair trade practices process like we do here in the U.S.? So where I'm going with this is if this was a U.S. corporation showing the seal or the attestation on their website and they weren't upholding the principles, our Federal Trade Commission can come after them for unfair and deceptive trade practices because they're publicly posting something they actually don't do. So that's one way of enforcement that you can go through. And I don't know if Europe has a similar type of enforcement process.
Yeah, we definitely have a similar legal framework also in Europe. Of course, if you make a false or deceptive representation towards the market, you will bear potential consequences for that. However, I think that it is not really our intention to go so far into, you know, what is going to be the effect of not adhering or not keeping compliance with the framework.
Mm-hmm. Because but that's the difference between Europe and the U.S. Y'all like the carrot. We need the stick.
Yeah. No, but believe me, I think we also in Europe, we need the stick sometimes. But I think the whole idea here is more, as I clearly stated at the beginning of the research, we want to generate a virtuous competition, okay?
Right.
And by generating virtuous competition, we go back to what we mentioned before. Consumers are looking for that. Investment funds and shareholders are looking for that. What is going to be in case of misrepresentation? Then we leave it to the actual legal system. We don't want to interfere with that. We just want to bring on the market and more generally to the digital society an additional tool, an additional framework that can combine, you know, the idea of doing business and doing it in a responsible way, protecting individuals. And this is where we want to stay focused. And we hope that by generating attention around it, then you know, then there will be even other researchers or institutions try to look into how to even enforce in a more effective way, you know, the fulfillment and compliance to this framework.
Well, you can tell I like your framework. I'm already thinking 10 steps ahead.
Thank you.
But Paolo, isn't it too soon to launch a framework like this? I think many companies are still struggling with basic GDPR compliance, maintaining their register and implementing all their policies and procedures, although that maybe should have been done already. But it is for many still a struggle. Isn't this maybe too aspiring?
I don't think so, but I think I question myself a lot about the fact that this framework may generate competitive divide in Europe. In the sense that, like the GDPR, is very demanding and you need to have budget, money and organization to comply with it in order to try to keep the risk under control. And this is not something for small and medium enterprises. So, as I mentioned, very straightforward also to European institutions in public speech that the GDPR is de facto creative. A competitive disadvantage for small and medium enterprises because they are exposed to an unknown risk of sanctions. To some extent, this framework may potentially work in a similar way because this is on top of the investment in terms of money, time, and organization that companies have done in the past years with respect to the GDPR. And, you know, the many other obligations that are coming with other legal sources in the pipeline within the European Union. So it is potentially a framework, again, for large corporations. But at the end of the day, probably this is exactly the main target, because the one that are putting in place data processing activities that maybe on the face of it are in line with the privacy framework. But at the end of the day, they create discrimination, limitation of fundamental rights and freedoms. Most of the time are the corporations.
Right.
So I think it's not too soon. It's exactly the right time to try to trigger this next level of competition, virtuous competition in the corporation world.
Now, I'll admit that when I looked at it, and maybe this is also coming from the scrappy American side as opposed to the big corporate view, but I looked at your framework as almost a roadmap for companies that do not have their GDPR compliance in place yet, that they can use this as this is what we should aspire to.
Yeah, it could be seen also as a roadmap towards an improvement of the compliance posture, I think. But I think the framework is also something to systematize activities that big corporations are already doing.
Right.
So a lot of corporations are actually already thinking about ethical aspects of, for example, machine learning. And the framework gives the possibility to put this within a specific control and tick a box and say, yes, okay, so this is something that we are doing, not anymore in an isolated way, but as part of a socially responsible behavior. There are already organizations that are addressing environmental issues. And, you know, by enforcing a data retention policy, strict data retention policy, by enforcing the principle of data minimization and proportionality, may also show that also with respect to data processing activity, they are doing something good for the environment.
Right.
So this is just to give you a couple of examples that in our discussion, especially with business stakeholders, we have appreciated that the 25 controls are, some of them are already present in the workflow of large corporations. And the framework gives the possibility to showcase that and to systematize their effort within a specific goal, which is about fulfilling this concept of data protection as a corporate social responsibility.
Well, Kay, I think we've got our work cut out for us.
Well, I think so.
If you look at it as a roadmap, then we have lots to do and to get ready.
There's a long stretch of road ahead of us, is what you're saying. Long stretch of road.
To get ready for that certification. I'm sure Paolo will look kindly upon us when assessing whether we are ready or not. But with that, we should wrap up this episode, one another episode of Serious Privacy. If you like our series, please do tell your friends and colleagues about us and rate and review our episodes in your favorite podcast app or on your favorite platform. Should you have any questions or suggestions, please reach out to us while Kay is crashing her desk down. Should you have any questions or suggestions, please reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustark.com or info@seriousprivacy.eu or via Twitter @podcastprivacy. You will find us on LinkedIn. Look for Serious Privacy. You will find Kay on Twitter as Heart of Privacy and myself as your OP. Until next week, goodbye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.